Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Land of the Rising Golden Silent Films podcast, or at least a very Americanized version of said podcast. Now, this episode's port of call is the 1919 Hayworth Pictures produced film in Japan set The Dragon Painter, starring Tsuru Aoki and Sesu Hayakawa. How realistic its depiction is remains to be seen, but the discussion, I'm sure, will be fascinating. Before we paint our own little picture of this film, let's give the usual Golden Silent Films podcast social media hangout information. As usual, travel on over to Golden Silence Cast on Instagram for all your up-to-date info on this globe-trotting podcast. And for all of you fine folks on Twitter and or X, just follow at GoldenSilence1 or just search Golden Silence Cast and we probably ought to appear. All these screen names and sites will be in the episode description in case you're interested in checking us out. We always want you to have fun on the show and embark with us on this journey. And at both of these social spaces, you'll get those behind-the-scenes pictures, information, upcoming episode reveals, and other fun film-related materials. And never forget a new season's worth of fun photos of our not-so-artistic podcasts, Soda and Gizmo. Also, if you're out there in the world listening to this program on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, do leave a review, a rating, or both. Our show has been around for over 3 years now, and we only have 11 reviews on iTunes. The show is within spitting distance of 10,000 listens, and we would really love more reviews, comments, and overall general interaction. We would love to see that review number grow, and you marvelous movie buffs out there can make that happen. All of those ratings and reviews help so, so much. Live your best review-leaving life and help our show grow and reach fellow silent film fans across the globe. Whether getting us more exposure in the world of podcasts or letting us know how we can improve, we appreciate that feedback and always want to bring you the best shows possible. And do subscribe to the Golden Silent Films podcast. While our output can be a bit spotty, when you are subscribed, you'll never miss an episode. The moment new content drops, it will travel straight to your listening device of choice. We are roaming the silent cinematic globe, and we do not want you to miss a second of the action. The version of the film we'll be looking at comes from the online streaming world of YouTube. As much as we love physical media here, for cost and convenience, we had to go the online route for this feature. If you want to snag this movie on disc, though, look no further than the fine folks at Kino Lorber. Through their website, you can get a copy of the William Worthington-directed Dragon Painter, along with the added bonus of 1914's The Wrath of the Gods as a special feature. As far as our YouTube viewing is concerned, there are some really top-notch versions out there to be had. One of my viewings of this movie was actually a colorized version, which actually looked really cool. There were some odd colorized moments, but overall, it was a great, fun experiment. Other more accurate and non-colorized copies exist as well. These prints were from the George Eastman House. It was part of a preservation and restoration project of the National Center for Film and Video Preservation at the American Film Institute. This is a film that is must-see, and with its wide availability, both physically and online, watching should be no problem. Another invaluable resource in the research of this episode is the return of a biographical favorite here at the show. In our earlier Sesu Hayakawa episode, which you can find in episode 12 of the first season, we really got a lot of great information from author and Hayakawa biographer Daisuke Miao. His book, Sesu Hayakawa, Silent Cinema in Transnational Stardom, was an amazing, incredibly researched biography that told the story of a forgotten idol of the silent world. It is definitely worth a read for any silent film fan out there, for sure. Now for this episode, we will be casting our gaze on the wife of Sesu Hayakawa, and major film star in her own right, Tsuru Aoki. Much like her husband, Aoki was a trailblazer in movie land with a life story worthy of a biographical deep dive. This is all a lead-in to say that Miao's book, whilst focusing on Hayakawa, provides a lot of great stories, background, and analysis into the life of Tsuru Aoki. In addition to that rad resource, another big show shout-out goes to Sarah Ross, who wrote a great piece entitled The Americanization of Tsuru Aoki: Orientalism, Melodrama, Star Image, and the New Woman. This incredible read can be found in Camera Obscura 60, and more specifically, Volume 20, Number 3. This can also be found online if the physical is a little too obscura. All of these items really came together to make for a great research experience. We work hard here and hope all of this makes for a compelling and interesting listen for you out there as well. Now, this episode is releasing smack dab in the midst of Women's History Month here in the States, so it's a perfect time to celebrate with this episode's biography segment all about Suru Aoki. For this stop of the world tour, we had to look at some of the best and most well-known Japanese actors and actresses of the day, and there were no better talents to chat about than the fantastic Suru Aoki and Sesu Hayakawa. In our previous Sesu Hayakawa biography episode way back in season 1, we touched briefly on the life of Aoki. We were really excited to do this episode and finally give Aoki that lead spot and really shed some light on this incredibly talented actress. Now, her life story is really a wild one, filled with twists and turns that all eventually brought her to Hollywood. Suru Aoki was born in Tokyo, Japan on September 9, 1892. Aoki came to California in 1899 with her uncle Kawakami Otajiro and his geisha wife Kawakami Sadayako, and Otajiro's troupe of actors. This is one of the constants in young Aoki's life. Being raised in the presence of actors and artists would greatly inspire the girl and lead to a groundbreaking Hollywood career. Author and Sesu Hayakawa biographer Daisuke Miao takes us deeper into the impact of these two on the Japanese entertainment industry and how they aim to globalize it. Miao writes, Sadayako, together with her husband Kawakami Otajiro, who tried to modernize Japanese theater by disassociating it from the dominant world of kabuki and pleasure quarters. Sadayako's geisha dance and act of dying and Kawakami's act of harakiri were sensationally received not only by the popular audience, but by some intellectuals and artists, including the renowned sculptor Auguste Rodin. This is really hammered home in an article on silentfilm.org. The article reads, Aoki comes from a rich acting pedigree. Her uncle, Otajiro Kawakami, owned Japan's Imperial Theater and sought to reform kabuki traditions by depicting the ordinary lives of the Japanese and incorporating Western plays as well as women performers, who had been banned from all stages from 1629 until 1891. The article continues, Aoki's aunt by marriage was the famous former geisha Sadayako, ni Sadakoyama. She later became the first woman to perform on the modern Japanese stage as part of her husband Otajiro Kawakami's troupe, and together they toured the world, their performances drawn from both Japanese and Western texts. Now, that's all well and good, but those were written by an outside bystander. How about we hear about Suru's life from the star herself? Let's have Suru Aoki explain it in her own words in an interview with Viola McConnell, a writer for Picture Goer magazine. In the February 1922 issue, McConnell interviewed Suru and Sesu for an article entitled East Meets West. This is definitely an article of its time, and you'll really hear that in some of the comments added in by Viola McConnell. Via Suru's mouth and McConnell's pen, we learn, I was adopted by my uncle Kawakami and my aunt Sadayako. Now, McConnell adds, I shan't attempt to reproduce the sound of these names. You'll have to hear it to believe it. Going back to Aoki, and they trained me for the stage. When I was 7, these two brought me from Tokyo to America, where they toured the United States in repertory. Theirs was the first all-Japanese company to attempt such a thing. At San Francisco, the authorities decided that I was too young to appear, so I was sent to boarding school, where I remained after my relatives had gone their way. I was then formally adopted by the artist T. Aoki, whose name I still use. Suru Aoki started taking lessons in ballet dancing in New York City when she went along with her uncle, who was hired by David Belasco for The Darling of the Gods. After her uncle's death, a reporter looked after the young Aoki. Aoki's stage career began when she moved to Los Angeles and started performing in stage productions in the city's Japanese theater. As a part of these productions, Aoki's talent caught the eye of big-time film producer Thomas Ince. Knowing talent when he saw it, Ince soon contractually scooped the young lady up. She, in turn, was also responsible for recruiting Japanese actors for Imperial Japanese Company, a subsidiary of New York Motion Picture Corporation. On December 12, 1913, Variety reported that the New York Motion Picture Corporation would produce a series of 5 real films about Japan, starring the Japanese actress Suru Aoki, who had already appeared in Fred Mace's comedy films and a majestic film, The Oath of Osuru-san. 2 weeks later, the NYDM reported that a Japanese village was under construction at Innsville, the NYMPC studio in the Santa Ynez Canyon between Santa Monica and Malibu, named after Ince, writes Daisuke Miao. Aoki made her film debut in the Majestic Film Studios' release, The Oath of Osuru-san, in 1913, like we mentioned. In this flick, she starred opposite actor William Garwood. Her follow-up appearance came in 1914 with a Thomas Ince-produced O Mimi-san. This picture starred child actress Mildred Harris and young man whom Aoki had acted with on stage at the Japanese theater the previous year. Now, I could tell you his name, but that would spoil the surprise. Well, maybe it's not that much of a surprise for a lot of you regular listeners of the show. We'll turn back to the interview that Aoki had with Viola McConnell and let her tell you about that fateful co-star. After that, I went to Ince as a star, Aoki told McConnell, and whilst I was working there, I met a fellow countryman new to America. Like myself, he had been on the stage with Kawakimi and Madame Yako in Tokyo. Like me, too, he had been educated here in America. We met at a social function, and I was very much interested in his brave attempts to play Ibsen and Shakespeare in Japanese at the Japanese Theater in Los Angeles, and promised to help in any way I could. I told him about my cherished plan to return to Japan someday and go on reforming the theater like my uncle and aunt had been doing, and I found that our ideals were identical. Afterwards, when the precarious Japanese theater was no more, I introduced him to Mr. Ince, and his name, Sesu Hayakawa, appeared in the cast of the film I was then starring in, The Wrath of the Gods. Speaking of The Wrath of the Gods, let's speak a little bit more about that classic disaster flick and Aoki's role in the film proper, and the advertising that went along with it. The film centers around an American sailor, played by Frank Borghese, who comes to the Yamaki family after finding himself shipwrecked. The sailor soon falls in love with their daughter, Toya-san, played wonderfully by Suru Aoki. This little affair commences unaware of the fact that she is cursed by God, a curse saying that if she marries, a nearby volcano will erupt and destroy the entire island on which the family lives. A Japanese Pompeii-Vesuvius scenario, if you will. The filming of this disaster feature was a whirlwind event. Thomas Ince wasn't one to let the news cycle pass by without trying to capitalize on it for film fodder and sales potential in theaters across the country. The eruption of the Sakurajima volcano on January 11, 1912, provided the backdrop for the upcoming film. It was the most powerful eruption in 20th century Japan, flowing and exploding from a volcano that had been dormant for over a century until that fateful day. Luckily, due to earthquakes and various pre-eruption indicators, the death toll was kept to a minimum. According to Daisuke Miao, the filming of Wrath of the Gods began on January 27, 1914, only 15 days after the eruption, and finished on February 13th. The eruption of Sakurajima was not only a subject with hot news value, but also a good opportunity for Ince to make a spectacular film with an authentic depiction of Japan and its people. While the volcano destroyed a lot of lives in the film, the overall movie itself was responsible for the birth of many careers for those Asian actors who worked so hard to make The Wrath of the Gods a success. The film was an incredible hit at the box office. It opened on June 7, 1914, at the Strand Theater in New York City. Ads and press surrounding the film's opening touted it as the biggest hit ever, and saying box office records were broken, and it received unprecedented applause. Moviegoers weren't the only ones to benefit from this picture. It was so big, in fact, that Ince signed Aoki and 12 of her fellow actors, including Sesu Hayakawa. Don't forget, this was a time when white folk were the main players of Asian roles in American movies. This troupe getting film contracts was a big moment for the American movie industry. Whilst still not the height of diversity, it was definitely a step in the right direction. As for her character in particular, Aoki's role in The Wrath of the Gods was a bit of a departure from many of her other film roles before and after. She really changed things up from her usual resume, and gave the movie-going public something different from their expected Asian roles of the era. Sarah Ross, in her essay for Camera Obscura, writes, "While her film roles in some ways reiterated stereotypes of the Asian woman, such as the innocent flower, the self-sacrificing Madame Butterfly, and the picture bride, Aoki's performances must also be understood to fit into larger patterns of change in on-screen heroines. Victorian melodramatic types were being transformed and, as time went on, merged with modern types to better match the social and sexual mores of the modern audience. Now, remember how I mentioned the advertising of Wrath of the Gods? Let's take a look back at that magical world of fantasy that Thomas Ince built around this picture and its star actress. Now, this era of filmdom is known for the movers and shakers of the movie industry realizing fiction can be fun and selling the movie-going public on manufactured backstories of the stars. Want to hear the fascinating but not so factual backstory of Suru Aoki and her connection to Sakura Jima? Well, it's your lucky day, folks. Let's turn our attention to the January 31st, 1914 issue of Motion Picture Magazine, where we read, "It so happens that Miss Aoki is a native of the island of Sakura, which was practically destroyed by the eruption of the volcano Sakura Jima. Miss Aoki, having lost practically all her relatives in this eruption, was inconsolable, and Mr. Ince thought he was due to lose her, that she would have to go back home. But in consoling her, he induced her to work in conjunction with him on a thrilling and powerful heart interest story entitled The Wrath of the Gods, a four-reel domino feature revolving around Japanese legend and depicting the scenes and actions of her countrymen during the eruption so that they could show the world the sufferings of her people." In an article for the Daily Mirror website, Mary Mallory writes, "Though he believed in authenticity on screen, Ince had no problem with crafting elaborate false biographies a la Theta Bara to help promote films. Before the feature, The Wrath of the Gods, Ince had released a false biography of Aoki claiming that she was a native of the island of Sakura, almost destroyed by the volcano in 1914, with most of her relatives killed in the eruption. The sheet stated that Ince had convinced her to star in the film to reveal the Japanese people's sufferings to the world. Per Brian Taves in his biography of Thomas Ince, Aoki gave a restrained, thoughtful performance, helping to somewhat rein in Hayakawa's overacting. After a life of acting in roles of love interests of all sort, Aoki and Hayakawa would formally start down the road to power couple in 1913, with it blossoming into full-blown wedded bliss on May 14, 1914. This was a mere few weeks before the release of The Wrath of the Gods. Sarah Ross writes, "The success of the Hayakawa's marriage is furthermore attributed to their ability to compromise and adapt, and to their self-realization through the consumer lifestyle. The stereotype that adaptability was a Japanese characteristic, widely circulated in publicity, undergirds this construction of the couple. In depictions of the Hayakawa's home life, it is the oriental touches that suggest a retreat to old-fashioned marital values, while markedly American consumer goods introduce the element of fun and playfulness necessary to the companionate marriage." This public image would be reiterated by magazine articles and publicity of the era. In fact, in an article for Motion Picture World entitled "A Romance in Nippon Land" by Pearl Gaddis, we read, "Miss Hayakawa, the dainty hummingbird-like person who so adores her seshu, will help him. In her old age, she will make him chop suey that he likes with his dinner. And when he is tired after his day's work, she will do as she does now. She will sing a little song to him about plum trees in bloom and birds in trees. And in the dim future, Sesu expects to go back to Japan on the stage. But it will only be a passing visit. He loves America. Everything about him is American, particularly his wife." When you listen to that quote, there is so much to unpack in that little snippet. And most of that stuff being unpacked is incredibly offensive and wrong on a few different levels. It is definitely a piece from its time, and it shows you that despite the great work Aoki was doing, she really was overlooked, especially in relation to her husband. It was stuff like this that really shows you how people and their achievements can be diminished, downplayed, and lessened, and really shows how talents can be lost to time. Back on the professional side of things, Aoki appeared regularly in shorts and features while under the employ of Thomas Ince. These roles saw Aoki continue with characters of Japanese origin, while adding to her repertoire with Chinese, Indian, and Native American characters. These roles garnered the actress quite a bit of attention and publicity from the articles in trade publications with, this is awesome, with the occasional cover shot here and there. All told, the mid-1910s was very lucrative for Aoki, creatively and financially. In addition to her star turn in The Wrath of the Gods, 1914 would see Aoki appear in an incredible 16 films. A small sample of those 16 include The Geisha, The Star of the North, and The Vigil. If those don't sound too familiar, there's a reason. Only three of her 1914 pictures still exist today. Yet another example of films lost to time. During this prolific run in the teens, Aoki was able to star opposite Sesu fairly often, which was really cool. Now at this time, Sesu Hayakawa was also riding the wave of popularity and was able to parlay his behind-the-scenes stroke with a little entrepreneurship. Hayakawa truly was at this time a giant in the industry, and he had the talent to back it up. In 1918, Hayakawa formed Hayworth Pictures Corporation. He started his own studio as an outlet to allow for Asian actors and performers to make films and appear in films that were outside the cultural norms and stereotypes of the day. And one person who benefited from this new venture was, you guessed it, Suru Aoki. Some of her most well-known performances came in Hayworth-produced pictures. In addition to quality roles, Aoki again was able to work alongside her husband quite often. Her work for Hayworth, the Women Film Pioneers website explains, included a role opposite Hayakawa in The Courageous Coward, 1919, in which she played a Japanese woman who tries to transform herself into a modern American girl in the mistaken belief that this is what her American suitor desires. WID's weekly advertising copy for the film proclaimed that she was delightful in her efforts to imitate her Western sisters in everything from high heels to powder puffs. Now, another big hit for Aoki during her time at Hayworth came as the, I don't know, I guess you could say anti-muse in 1919's The Dragon Painter, directed by William Worthington. But we're going to put a pin in that topic for now and switch for a little bit and dive into the Hayworth Pictures artistic production and Robertson Cole distributed film in a little bit. But before we get to the movie breakdown proper, let's go back to the formative years of The Dragon Painter. In fact, as strange as it sounds, the earliest part of this Japanese novel slash film was born in the southern United States during the U.S. Civil War in the 1860s. Let's go back in time to a point long before the book and the film. Let's start this backstory with the birth of Mary McNeil on March 8, 1865 in Wilcox County, Alabama. And I don't need MapQuest to be fairly certain that Alabama is a bit of a drive from Japan. But the real fun lies in how this country girl like McNeil ends up writing such an evocative tale of the Far East. Now, as I mentioned, McNeil was born in Alabama at the tail end of the Civil War. Her parents were William Stoddard McNeil, a Confederate Army lieutenant from Mobile, Alabama, and Laura Sibley. McNeil was the oldest of five children. By the age of 18, she was married, and by 20, she was a widow raising an infant child. She would be proposed to by a W. Ledyard Scott, a former suitor who was a professor of English and Latin at Zoshikwan College in Kagoshima, Japan. After sailing to Tokyo, she married Scott in 1890. However, the marriage was not a happy one, and in 1892, she divorced Scott and returned to the United States, now with two children. Her time in Japan would serve her well and lead to gainful Japanocentric employment. In 1895, while working at the Asian Art Division of the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, she became an assistant to Ernest Fenollosa. This fellow was a renowned American expert on Japanese art and culture. The two became romantically involved, and Fenollosa divorced his wife. This whole sequence of events would prove quite scandalous in the late 1800s Boston. It caused such a ruckus, Fenollosa was forced to leave his post at the museum. The two soon moved to New York, but the couple returned to Japan in 1897 following a long honeymoon cruise. When they returned to Japan, Fenollosa became official arts commissioner to the Japanese emperor, and Mary began to write. Despite and because of his incredible depth of knowledge and experience in all matters Japanese, Fenollosa played a big part in the culture spreading in the United States. According to Daisuke Miao, Ernest Fenollosa had an influential role in forming Japanese taste among middle-class Americans. His wife's novel was written in this trend. Now, the Dragon Painter novel itself was released in 1906. Her later output would never quite reach the heights of the Dragon Painter, though. By 1919, Mary McNeil Fenollosa had stepped away from writing and would pass away in Montrose, Alabama on January 11, 1954, at the ripe old age of 88. As we paint our way out of the novel and into the movie breakdown, I'm going to be upfront with you fine folks. I know this film is by no means a super authentic look at life in Japan. The Dragon Painter, it's about as Americanized as a Japanese movie could be. While this world tour of 2024 loves seeking out the best of foreign silent films, there are also great avenues to go down with American films that star some of the brightest international talents. Now, one of the cool things about this season of the Golden Silent Films podcast is examining the whole width and breadth of how so many different cultures, histories, and experiences have impacted the world of silent film. And the varied way these influences make their way into the cinematic is super cool and leads to so many rabbit holes. The other big star and spouse of this film is Sessue Hayakawa. He is a favorite here at the offices of the Golden Silent Films podcast. In fact, he is such a favorite that we dedicated two past episodes to the man. Our 11th episode covered his star turn in 1915's The Cheat, and we followed that up with a full biography of the trailblazing leading man. The life of Sessue Hayakawa is incredibly fascinating on a lot of levels, and we hope you hop back to check out those episodes for a fuller look at one of the biggest stars of the silent era. All of that is to say, we have a lot of love for Hayakawa and a lot of Hayakawa content to offer. As a result of that, we decided to take a different look at the actor for this episode. Now, The Dragon Painter is one of a handful of films Hayakawa starred in and produced in 1919. This was the ninth of 22 features produced at Hayworth, actually. 1919 was a wild year, and we thought it would be a cool place, a cool slice of life to look as we prepared to dive into his artistically inclined period piece, The Dragon Painter. Japanese culture was all the rage in the late 1800s and early 1900s. It was one of the reasons the works of Mary McNeil and Ernest Fenollosa were able to capture the zeitgeist, and those rising waters lifted the ships of Sessue Hayakawa and Soru Aoki. Their stars shot to the moon with the frenzy towards all things Japanese and pop culture. And speaking of ships, let's take a look at where this all started. Now, the United States adored everything Japanese in the early late 1800s and early 1900s. After Commodore Matthew Perry and his ships entered Tokyo Harbor in 1853, fascination and a craze for the arts and culture of Japan skyrocketed. Textiles, ceramics, prints, philosophy, and even gardens soon became popular, with the term Japanism created to describe the country's influence. Operas, plays, and books centered around Japanese themes and characters, with many Americans viewing the culture as more refined, pure, and moral because of its focus on honor and family, writes Mary Mallory. But let's rewind a bit and set the stage now for 1918 and the wealth of creativity and entrepreneurship to come in 1919 for Sessue Hayakawa. In March of 1918, Hayakawa's contract with Jesse L. Lasky expires. By now, though, by that point, Hayakawa was a big name and wanted parts, roles, and movies commensurate with his stature. Roles that would portray Asians in more positive lights. This venture would turn into the first Asian-owned production company. Author Dice K. Miao writes that this venture was a simultaneous campaign of winning the hearts of American audiences by clinging to his already established star image, and convincing Japanese-American communities of his more authentic depiction of Japanese characters. Like I mentioned, the man was big business. In reading an article about the Dragon Painter on the Amazing Movies Silently website, you learn he had the chops to back it up. The author writes, "I am going out on a limb, but if you cornered me and forced me to name the best actor of the teens, I would have to say Hayakawa. He possessed the rare gift of being able to underplay intensity. He was virile, he was dignified, he was certainly one of the handsomest actors of his day." Now, a July of 1918 edition of Motion Picture World talks about Hayakawa's new production company with some insights from the man himself. The article reads, "In these first productions and others which are to follow, he, Hayakawa, said a few days ago while discussing his work, 'I am happy to say I will have the splendid opportunity for the kind of acting which most appeals to me and I'm sure makes the most profound impression upon the audience. The repressive, natural kind, devoid of gesticulation and heroics. Danjuro, idol of the Japanese stage, was this sort of actor. My aim is to be like him, and if I succeed, I shall feel I have not labored in vain before the camera. The article continues, Hayakawa sent several of his company to Japan to film scenes for the initial production. They have just returned, bringing with them about 4,000 feet of film taken in Tokyo and Yokohama and in the wonderfully beautiful Mount Fujiyama region. But what good is a cool film production company without an equally cool name, right? There was a lot of inspiration for Hayakawa to draw from as he was putting his trailblazing company together. But in this case, the silver screen idol kept things simple. Simple while still saying quite a bit. Before anything else, the name of Hayakawa's company, Hayworth, symbolizes the careful mediation between his Americanized star image and his Japanese national identity to reestablish his popularity, which cut across racial lines. No record is left concerning the details of naming his company, but Hayworth seems to be the combination of the H.A. from Hayakawa and the Worth from William Worthington, who was Hayakawa's right-hand man and directed 12 out of the first 13 Hayakawa vehicles at Hayworth, writes Dice K. Meow. So, with all the preliminary festivities out of the way, get out your paints, canvases, mysterious dragon princesses, and let's be ready to be infotained. Hayworth Pictures Corporation presents The Dragon Painter, directed by William Worthington, camera by Frank D. Williams, art direction by Milton Manasco, scenario by E. Richard Scheer, based on the novel The Dragon Painter by Mary McNeil Fenollosa. The cast, Sesu Hayakawa as Tatsu the Dragon Painter, Suru Aoki as Umiko, Edward Peel as Kano Indara, and Toyo Fujita as Undobuchita. Now, while we're focused on the character names, let's take it a little deeper. Though this film purports to be authentically Japanese, one of the first giveaways that something is off comes in the characters' names. I'm just a goofy American podcaster, so naturally the nuance of Asian naming conventions is lost on me, but Asian audiences everywhere, something is definitely amiss. Dice K. Meow explains, the imaginary Orientalist aspect of the Dragon Painter is indicated first by its choice of strange Japanesque names. Undobuchita, Kano Indara, and Hanake for the place where the hero lives. Katsudo Karubo, a Japanese film magazine, pointed out, even though Mr. Sesu Hayakawa took subject matter from Japan, Japanese names and styles in The Dragon Painter are very inappropriate. A film about Japan that does not properly depict Japanese customs is very hard to watch for us Japanese. Now, the film opens proper in the aforementioned Hanaki Mountains in Japan. The Dragon Painter utilizes the Eurocentric archetypal dichotomy between wilderness and civilization. The opening shot, an extreme long shot of Hanaki, artificially combines the actual location of Yosemite Valley and Japanesque objects such as a torii, and establishes Japan as a wild and picturesque place. The mountains, waterfalls, and rocks of Yosemite are displayed in the background, signifying nature and wilderness. The clouds move fast, as if they were shown in fast motion, and thus enhance the fantastic atmosphere, writes Dice K. Meow. In those mountains lived a young, brilliant artist of untamed genius. His name was Tatsu, aka the Dragon Painter. This is our first look at Sesu Hayakawa as an artist. He sits in a chair contemplating his next work, paper in hand. The frustrated artist crumples the paper and tosses it away. Tatsu looks wild, like a man living in the woods. He is very unkempt and is the opposite to the people around him in the surrounding villages. He has lived a hard life of sorrow and obsession and looks every bit the part. And Hayakawa does a great job in this role with small, nuanced actions that really sell the anxiety and fervor of his character, which you're going to see more of as the film progresses. The now emotionally distraught painter makes his way up a hill before yelling to the mountains, divinity of the mountains, hear my prayer. Return my princess, my fiance, whom you have changed into a dragon 1,000 years ago by the strength of your enchantments. And that, folks, is the crux of this film. There's a commotion in the village down below. Tatsu heads down. After throwing a child around wantonly, he demands paper. Has inspiration struck? Some villagers surround the wild artist. "Go away, you apes. Stop looking at me like that," he yells at them. Hayakawa's pantomimic gestures and psychologically explicit facial expressions in the films made at Hayworth moved Hayakawa's stardom closer to that of contemporaneous white American actors. In comparison, the dragon painter placed Hayakawa in a supposedly Japanese landscape. However, even in the surrounding, Hayakawa resorted to more pantomimic gestures and emotionally filled facial expressions. So, paper is provided and Tatsu runs off. The villagers remain, some puzzled by what has even really just happened. One villager explains, "It's Tatsu, the dragon painter. He says he seeks an enchanted princess whom the spirits took from, and he paints strange pictures." It's like the villager read the previous intertitle. Now we change locations and head far from there to Tokyo, where Kano Indara lived. He was the last descendant of a family of illustrious painters. We see him in his studio and learn the genius of the Indaras would end with him, because he didn't have a son and had not found a disciple whom he deemed worthy to continue his art. This is our introduction to Edward Peele portraying Kano Indara. The cast of this film is a great use of Japanese actors taking well-deserved center stage. For the most part, the always incredible Movie Silently website expands on this one exception. The lone Caucasian actor in a major Japanese role, the article reads, Edward Peele uses minimal makeup and does not stoop to the weird shuffling mannerisms and lip puckering that often mar such performances. While it would have been better to have an all-Japanese cast, I really have no complaints about Peele, considering when and where this film was made. He is respectful and dignified. In addition to our introduction to the master artist, we are also presented with his daughter, Umi Ko. She is played by Suru Aoki, and we see the girl painting. We swing our attention back to Kano, who is given pictures other young artists have painted in the hopes that they can become the apprentice to this painting master. He looks over them, but nothing really sets his light on fire. There's no interest. There's nothing that really grabs him. He seems resigned to the fact that he will never find anyone worthy of carrying on his name. He is heartbroken and inconsolable at this thought. This Tokyo bit leads us to one of the big differences between novel and film. The original novel begins in Tokyo, Miao explains, and there is no opening scene that describes Tatsu in the wilderness. In the film, instead, a scene at Kano's refined house in Tokyo is inserted into the opening scene at Haneke. This cross-cutting between Haneke and Tokyo emphasizes the image of Japan positioned in the middle ground between wilderness and civilization. We are now back with Tatsu, deep in nature, seeking inspiration from a beautiful waterfall. He is really unhappy with his work, however. He smashes it up and throws it into the wind. The wind carries it to some passerbys who catch the sheets and are amazed by the quality of this thrown-away painting. They're super curious as to who could have painted such gorgeous works. One of them knows and says it was painted by Tatsu, the madman. They see Tatsu up on the cliff. They yell at him, but he wants no interactions on this day. One of the men, a surveyor named Uchida, knows a trick to get the reclusive artist down. He yells, "I know where to find your enchanted princess, Tatsu. Come down quickly." Now, in this film, Uchida is played by Toyo Fujita. Fujita was born on July 16, 1893 in Japan. In his home country, Fujita was an accomplished actor on stages all across Japan. After moving to the United States, he continued his acting career in productions in Los Angeles and San Francisco. He also took an ownership role in the creative sector when he owned and operated a theater in LA's Little Tokyo neighborhood. This may have been where Fujita would cross paths with Sesu Hayakawa. Toyo Fujita passed away on July 25, 1959, in Santa Clara, California. Back to the film, we rejoin this crummy trick being pulled on poor Tatsu. Hearing news of his enchanted princess, Tatsu comes rushing down. But there was a method to the meanness. Uchida believes Tatsu is the artist that the old master Indara searches for in vain. He wants to introduce Tatsu to the master immediately. When Tatsu gets down to the men, he cares only for information pertaining to his princess. The man responds, "Easy, easy. Tell me one thing first. Why do you draw? For your pleasure?" In typical wild artist of the woods fashion, Tatsu cryptically replies, "I will only be happy when I've found my princess again. Until then, I will draw her features." To keep the charade going, while also doing a solid for old Kano and Dara, the man tells Tatsu, "Come to Tokyo, bud. I'm going to introduce you to someone who'll help you find her." Back in Tokyo, Kano is fretting and wallowing in self-pity. He feels himself getting older and older each day, and every day he has no apprentice. His sadness grows. Now, I can totally respect and appreciate what Kano and Dara is going through. As someone who has the two best cats in the world, and I'm talking about you, Gizmo and Soda, as someone who only has the two best cats in the world, I sympathize with him for not having an heir or protege to carry on his work and name. I mean, I love my cats, but realistically, I hardly think they're going to continue this podcast after I shuffle off this mortal coil. Maybe they'll surprise me, but I kind of doubt it. Now, Kano is having tea with his daughter when he gets a delivery. It's a letter from Uchida setting up the connection between Tatsu and Kano. The letter reads, "On the fifth day of the moon, I will bring to you a strange being who lives like a savage in the mountains, painting the portrait of his fiancée, a princess whom he claims the spirits changed into a dragon. This singular belief seems to be the source of his genius." It seems Uchida, the surveyor, also surveyed the first intertidal. Everyone has the crux of the story now. Kano tells his daughter of this hopeful, potential, possible pupil as they look at work. They are quite impressed, and Kano sets to preparing everything in his honor. You know, kind of woo the wild talent, impress him a bit. They are both ecstatic over this unexpected good news. And on that fifth day following the moon, Uchida had gotten Tatsu to Kano's front door, but the wild artist is having second thoughts. Uchida encourages him to continue on. They eventually make their way inside, where Kano and Dara waits. Uchida goes in first to make the introduction, saying Tatsu is waiting in the garden, not expecting the grand a welcome that awaits him. A real ceremonious presentation, if you will. While the other guys are glad-handing inside, the artist of the woods, Tatsu, is getting into some fish-out-of-water shenanigans in the garden. Hunting, prowling, crawling around. You can take the artist out of the beautiful waterfall-laden mountains, but you can't take the beautiful waterfall-laden mountains out of the artist, it would seem. As everyone awaits the arrival of Tatsu, Umiko is freshening up, hoping to look her best for what she assumes is a handsome, clean-cut artist. Outside, Tatsu has had enough. He storms into the house demanding to see Uchida. He has had enough waiting. Because he is a dirty mountain man, he has dirty mountain man feet, and the maid of the house won't let him inside in such a state. She washes his feet prior to entry. In The Dragon Painter, Hayakawa displays the physical strength of an action star. Tatsu jumps off rocks and runs into the wilderness. He raises his feet, trying to summon a dragon, Daisuke Miao writes. The action aspect of this movie and how Hayakawa played it also stood out to Sarah Ross. In her terrific essay, Ross writes, "In roles such as the wild man Tatsu in The Dragon Painter, Hayakawa displays an exuberant and nimble style of movement, reminiscent of Fairbanks' zany and boyish physicality in films such as Wild and Woolly. The dichotomy of East and West in his lifestyle is mobilized by a clash of primitive versus civilized, but is also presented as the gap between traditional and modern." Uchida introduces Tatsu to Kano and Dara. Tatsu only has one thing to ask the master. "Is it you who knows where the princess is hidden?" Knowing he needs to play the game a bit to see Tatsu's talent, Kano responds, "It is I, my friend, but sit down. Let's chat." We get some more fun fish-out-of-water hijinks as Tatsu deals with the luxury and comfort of Kano's parlor, since he is only used to the harsh, wooded environments. This all leads to Tatsu asking who he has been brought to meet. Kano is apoplectic at this indignation. "Is it possible that you are ignorant of the name Kano and Dara?" he asks. Kano only knows of Tatsu as a painter of dragons. Tatsu says he paints nothing else. Kano gives Tatsu a look at one of the paintings he was sent. He asks, "Where in the painting of the mountains and a river is the dragon?" Tatsu says it is sleeping under the water. Uchida and Kano have a good laugh. Tatsu, the old master, says, "You will be my disciple, my son." While this all seems great and a match made in artsy heaven, Tatsu wants none of it. He just wants his princess. Your son, he replies, you're crazy. It's obvious that no one knows where my princess is. Goodbye. Tatsu tries to leave, but the two men hold him back. This just makes Tatsu angrier. They eventually calm him down, telling him to sit. The enchantment of the princess is over, they tell him. She is going to appear. Doors slide open, and there is Umiko, looking gorgeous and capturing every bit of Tatsu's attention. With a small band behind her, she does a dance that enthralls and soothes the wild beast of a painter. He runs to her, but the doors close, and she is gone. Needless to say, this makes Tatsu really upset. If you value your life, make her reappear. She's mine, he yells at the two tricksters. Kano and Dara plays it super cool and explains everything like this. He says, the princess, as you have seen, is incarnated in the features of my daughter, Umiko. Tatsu is in shock at what he has seen. He darts over to Indara and demands her as his wife. Kano thinks for a moment. First, you have to prove that you are worthy of being my disciple and my son, the master fires back. This is a pretty good deal, if you ask Tatsu. To have her, I will accept all that you ask of me. The deal is struck and the men will sleep before the artistic work begins. However, Tatsu refuses the bed provided by Kano and Dara. I don't want a bed. I will sleep at the foot of the hill until tomorrow. And with that, Tatsu takes his leave in very dramatic fashion. Now, Daisuke Miao writes, nevertheless, it is doubtful that Hayakawa seriously wanted to make films that would portray more authentic Japanese people and their characteristics. The method that Hayakawa took was hardly original. Many early travelogue filmmakers had been sent to Japan to obtain images that would look authentic to foreign audiences, such as Mount Fuji or geisha dances. Miao continues, while admitting the fact that the bias of those days against Orientals was a great help to me and underscored it in our storylines, Hayakawa confessed later, at Hayworth I was not about to change away from the type of picture that had earned me my fame and following. Back to movie action, we see that night, Umiko can only think about the odd young painter she has just met, so much so that she sneaks her way out of the house to catch a glimpse of the wild man. She follows him outside. He grabs her from behind and they embrace. You are my princess, my fiancé, he tells her. For 1,000 years I have looked for you, engraving your features on the rocks and imploring the gods each day. She backs away. Have patience, my dragon painter. She runs back home, telling him that she must get back, but Tatsu says it was love that led her outside to him. Both present compelling arguments, for sure. Either way, she heads back in. Now, Tsuru Aoki was wonderful in this role for a number of reasons. Sarah Ross breaks down one of these reasons. She writes, Aoki's screen image is still more markedly distanced from the aggressive sexuality of the pseudo-Oriental vamp. Any sexuality attributed to her characters tended to be the result of victimization or self-sacrifice. Alternatively, she was often a chaste object of the hero's affection, a girlish figure and/or a loving daughter. Her screen persona thus had more in common with performers such as Lillian Gish and Mary Pickford than with exotic types like Theda Bara or Alla Nazimova. However, as with Gish and Pickford, it would be a mistake to regard her as purely passive type. The morning comes and Tatsu's imposed apprenticeship begins in earnest. Tatsu is quite surprised by his surroundings, mostly due to the fact that he has to be indoors and under a roof. The sheltered business is completely foreign to the man. Uchida says he will eventually get used to it. But there's more drastic changes in mind that Uchida has. He offers Tatsu new clothes because Tatsu only wears, being a wild man of the woods, only wears tattered robes. Tatsu spurns the offer. Not just spurns, but violently rejects the new threads. After the altercation, Tatsu begins painting, simmers down a little bit, and gets to work. He thinks of Umiko, and inspiration just pours out. It fires out onto that canvas. He feels the inspiration of his dragon princess running through him. Speaking of Umiko, she is in her room with her servant. Mistress, the servant asks, do you love this wild one, this mountain man? Umiko smiles and runs off and heads outside as Tatsu paints. Now, in the making of this movie, Sesu Hayakawa started Hayworth Pictures, but Hayworth Pictures was a production company. There was also Robertson Cole, who distributed the projects that Hayworth made. And in this little blurb we get from Daisuke Miao, we read, The Dragon Painter represented the careful result of Robertson Cole's high standardization, which stressed an Orientalist recreation of Hayakawa's star image. The Dragon Painter displayed the imaginary, exotic, and picturesque Japan that many American audiences had been accustomed to in films and travelogues about Japan since the late 19th century. Robertson Cole and Hayakawa fully exploited this expectation of American audiences. Now back to the film. The test has been judged conclusive by the old master, who has given his daughter to Tatsu and taken him on as a disciple. Now that things are official, the two lovebirds are sitting out in the beautiful garden. Umiko reminds Tatsu he promised to start a portrait of her. Now, while we're at this point in the proceedings, we see that love has changed Tatsu pretty drastically. The wild hair and torn clothes are gone. He is perfectly groomed and wears the finest of garments. His attitude has even changed. "I painted you before when I lost you," he says. "What use is it to paint you now that I've found you?" The two go to the lake where the waterfall sings. Back home, though, circumstances have changed as well. Indara tells Uchida that Tatsu has not worked since the marriage. Indara is pretty dismayed at this turn of events. When Tatsu and Umiko return, Indara wastes no time in trying to get his apprentice back into the painting mood. He gives him paint and a canvas. "Go back to work, my dear son," he tells him. Umiko stands there all cute-like, hoping to serve as some sort of inspiration to the painter, but it's no use. Tatsu seems to have some sort of performance anxiety. "I don't know what's wrong with me. I can no longer paint, he says. It's because you think about me too much," Umiko chimes in. "What else could I think about?" he answers. "I destroy the divine gift you possessed," Umiko answers back. Not to be outdone, Tatsu replies, "Your love knows how to bring it back." In an article from the Women Film Pioneers website, we read, "In the roles found in her existing films, Aoki adroitly enacts girlish enthusiasm for nature, demure consciousness of romantic encounters, and rebellious indignation. Her small stature is repeatedly emphasized by framing and staging, as when Hayakawa's character in The Dragon Painter effortlessly swoops her up in his arms and lifts her high in the air." Back to the film, despite Tatsu's positivity, the days that followed did not see the rebirth of the Dragon Painter's art. Instead, bitterness slid anew into the heart of Kano and Dara. And it wasn't just Indara, all three main folks were pretty down in the dumps at this point. They all sulked in their various sections of the compound. Tatsu rips his canvas and runs out to Umiko. As he reaches her, he hits a breaking point. "I don't want to paint anymore. I no longer know how. I don't have talent anymore. I am no longer good at anything," he exclaims. "That pretty much sums up my headspace every time I make a new episode. I go full Tatsu in front of the bedroom mirror before my inner Stuart Smalley takes over, reminding me I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me. Well, my cats do, at least. That's enough of my existential crisis for one episode, but getting back to the film, Tatsu realizes what is wrong. "I painted because you were lost to me," Tatsu's breakdown continues as Umiko realizes, "because I was lost?" Umiko runs into the house and picks up Tatsu's torn canvas. A terrible idea seems to have gotten into young Umiko's head. "I can't say I much like where this seems to be headed, not one bit." She tells her father, "He insists that since he found me, he can no longer paint." Sadness flows over the face of the girl. "If I were dead, perhaps his divine gift would return." "I don't like this one bit," her father tries to console the girl. The morning came when Tatsu, on rising, realized Umiko was not in bed next to him. In her place was a letter. It read, "Because I am the obstacle to the talent given you by the gods, I sacrifice to your glory my happiness and my life. I go to the leaning willow where the water speaks. Later, when you hear its murmur, perhaps you will recognize the echo of my voice. Oh, live, my beloved, that I, in spirit, may still be near you. I will come." Signed, Umiko. Tatsu is in shock reading this. He tells Kano and Dara and runs off in search of his love. Indara and the maid aren't far behind. Tatsu gets to the waterfall and sees one of Umiko's sandals at the edge of the cliff. Wasting no time, Tatsu dives in. Kano and the maid race down the river in hopes of finding the two. They cannot find Umiko, only an unconscious Tatsu floating downstream. For many days, Tatsu asked Death to deliver him from his torturous grief. He sits almost in a stupor, unable to really do much of anything. Tatsu tells Kano, "I don't want to eat. I want to be with Umiko, my princess." One night, though, a sleeping Tatsu has a vision of his beloved. He awakes the next morning in a frenzy. More visions of Umiko follow him. He demands canvas and painting utensils. He has been struck with vision and inspiration. He starts painting. His style is wild and seemingly a return to his old ways of madly creating art. Sorrow, we are told, had given back to Tatsu the mastery that love had taken. And later, at the exposition of his work, Tatsu is the toast of the town. His work of a warrior and his love fighting a dragon is getting the white folk at the museum all kinds of excited. The afterglow would only last so long. After his triumph, the grief returned. Tatsu sits in a very zen reflecting pond. We see his reflection looking into the calm waters. The reflection of another figure approaches. It's Umiko. A startled Tatsu quickly turns around to embrace his love, but she's gone. A down-and-out Tatsu gets up and walks through the gorgeous garden area. Tatsu is back in the house. He sees Umiko again. Is it another vision or reality? He looks at her forlorn. He refuses to get excited again about the phantom female. She reaches out to him. She calls to him, but Tatsu can't believe it. The two take each other's hand. Umiko tells Tatsu, "Now that sorrow has returned your genius, you have learned that love must be art's servant, I can take my place at your side again without remorse." They hug and the movie fades to the two on a mountaintop, Tatsu painting and Umiko by his side. The end. And I think the movie Silent Lee website perfectly sums up this film and its place in the greater silent film world. The article reads, "In many ways, the lesson of the film is an eloquent defense for the art of silent film itself. The lack of his princess drives Tatsu to be far more creative than he could have ever been otherwise. The lack of voices also forced silent film creators to come up with more innovative ways of telling their stories in a purely visual format." Now, like many movies of its time, it's a small miracle that the Dragon Painter even exists today. The pre-movie text of the print from the George Eastman House explains, "The print of the Dragon Painter was copied from a tinted nitrate print circulated in France at the original release. Possessing French intertitles, it was the only known surviving copy of the film. All copies of the film intertitled in English have apparently been lost to nitrate deterioration or neglect." The explanation continues, "The French titles have been retranslated to English, an facsimile of the company's lead credits made. The surviving nitrate print was recopied onto color safety film to retain as much as possible the effect of the original color tinting. Now, this restoration was an incredible effort made by many devoted folks in March of 1988. Now, as far as how I felt about this movie, I really have to say I enjoyed it a ton. It was fantastic. Well, it really didn't portray the most authentic Japanese experience. It did succeed in building a quasi-fantasy world. It made me feel as though I was watching a fairy tale play out on screen. It had a real magical vibe to it, which I thought was super cool. Now, the performances in the film were also really top-notch. This movie, it's a great showcase, obviously, for Suru Aoki. And really, that's what brings us here today, is the charm and talent of Suru Aoki. Her performance was fantastic on a few different levels, and I wasn't the only one to feel that way. Turning back to movie Silent Lee, we read, "Hayakawa's wife, Suru Aoki, is every bit his equal in talent. She has a fascinating face full of character, and she makes her challenging character believable. The concepts of self-sacrifice and balancing the cosmic scales are quite common in Japanese cinema. But these characteristics had to be packaged and sold to an American audience. Aoki is a marvel. Her movements are subtle, and she moves with a great grace, but she has a will of iron. Tatsu's talent is more important than either one of them, and her fierce determination to restore it is touching." The back and forth between Aoki and Hayakawa was brilliant. I know they were married, so the chemistry would be good, but they really put it to great use and effect in this movie. The way Umiko toys with Tatsu early on was incredibly charming and made for a fun game of cat and mouse. I wasn't the only person slash organization that loved this movie. In addition to being good business at the box office, general sentiment was really incredibly positive around The Dragon Painter. One of the especially fine features of the production is the laboratory work, mountain locations of extreme beauty chosen for the purpose of imitating Japanese scenery and supplying Japanese atmosphere are enhanced by the splendid results accomplished in the work of developing and toning, writes Margaret McDonald in a review in Motion Picture World. Furthermore, we read in Motion Picture World, in this setting, the village of Hakone, Japan, was duplicated even to its famous Shinto gates. Each setting is so naturally beautiful that it's hard to realize the perfection of the interior detail. The picturesqueness of the Land of the Rising Sun has been fully retained in The Dragon Painter. With the reviews laid to rest, how about we lay this episode to rest? Because that means it is time to find out where your favorite silent stars are laid to rest. This is a segment where we join our favorite cinematic stars on the other side of the cemetery gates. The history, the art, the celebrity spectacle converge, and where are they now? Your guide to paying your respects to the amazing actresses that have entertained us so much. As the on-screen career of Suru Aoki started winding down, there was still work to be done on stage. And much like their movie days, Aoki and Hayakawa would star opposite each other. The McLeod Times, a newspaper from, I believe, Alberta, Canada, on May 18, 1922, wrote, "Besides being the wife of Sesu Hayakawa, Suru Aoki has the distinction of being one of the most versatile of screen actresses. And in Mr. Hayakawa's most recent production, 5 Days to Live, one of the greatest subjects in which the noted star has ever appeared, Miss Aoki has a role for which her whimsical charm admirably equips her." After a series of moderately successful Ints produced 2-reel serials, Aoki's career in the United States began to falter, all the while her husband's career began to build momentum. In 1923, the couple traveled to France and filmed the popular Édouard-Émile Vallette-directed drama La Bataille shortly after. Now, film work wasn't the only thing causing the two to look for greener pastures elsewhere. The reality of life as a Japanese-American was becoming all too harsh. In an article from silentfilm.org, we learn, "Life became untenable for the Hayakawas in California with the continual stripping away of civil rights of Japanese Americans. The couple decamped first for New York, then England and France, appearing in a handful of films along the way, including 1924's La Bataille. The French revered Hayakawa since his appearance in The Cheat, but also fondly remembered Aoki's aunt, Sadayako. The Hayakawas eventually resettled in Japan, but she had already retired from the screen to raise their 3 children. In 1960, Suru made her final screen appearance alongside Sesu in the Hollywood film Held to Eternity after an absence of 36 years. So we're going to rewind a little bit, talk about that return to America. After returning to America, however, Aoki only made 3 more films before retiring from the screen to raise the children. Her last silent screen performance came in 1924 release, The Danger Line. Aoki returned to the screen in 1960, her first sound film and last sound film, and appeared with her husband in the aforementioned drama, Held to Eternity. She died the following year in Japan of acute peritonitis at the age of 69. Aoki was buried in the Shōen-jinja Shrine in her native Japan, and Tokyo to be more specific. Though not especially well known to mainstream film audiences, Suru Aoki carries with her an incredible history and impact on film, culture, and life all over the world. She was a truly special talent who blazed a trail for many who would follow in her path. We'll leave with one more quote from Daisuke Miao when he writes, "Moreover, in Japan, there were not many motion picture actresses until arguably as late as 1918, when Hanayagi Harumi starred in Sei no Kagayaki, or The Radiance of Life, a product of the film modernization movement. Before this film, there were onagata, female impersonators in kabuki, and only a few female actresses, including Marido Suzuko, Hanamura Nabuko, Miho Matsuko, and Hashimoto Yaiko, who appeared in motion pictures in Japan. Therefore, Suru Aoki was arguably one of the first female Japanese motion picture stars and became the template for actresses and stars in Japan." And with that, we put down the brush on this quasi-trip to the highly Hollywoodized version of Japan. While we say goodbye in Japanese for now, the wheels keep rolling on this journey of ours. We have a lot of great stops coming up and look forward to sharing the adventure with all of you. There are so many cool countries, personalities, and stories we can't wait to dive into with you fine co-travelers. While this episode didn't exactly take you to the most super 100% authentic land of the rising sun, we had to share the stories and talk about some of the finest actresses and actors to come out of Japan. Being able to really dive into the story of Suru Aoki was fun and incredibly enlightening. Our hope was to share a little bit of Japan with you out there, and hopefully we did a solid job of it. Did you enjoy the artistic ambitions of this world tour stop? What Japanese actors and actresses should we dig into next? We know there are many out there, and this is only the tip of the iceberg. Are you listening to this show in another country? If you are, we want to know where you're listening to it. We want to hear from you, and we can do all that and more at the various social media hotspots of the Golden Silent Films podcast. While we're mentioning the social media stuff, if you have forgotten, we are on Instagram and X, Twitter X. Let us know what your feelings are on this episode. What silent and silent-related movies, past or present, domestic or abroad, do you want us to look at next? Our wide world of silent movie knowledge and experience is always growing, and we need your input for our future episodes here in Season 4 and beyond. You can always find us at Golden Silence Cast on Instagram and at Golden Silence 1 on Twitter. And again, if you listen to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other podcast outlet that allows it, subscribe, rate, and review. It does a lot for our global visibility, and we love hearing your thoughts and ideas. We really, really appreciate all your incredible support and how much you find folks are listening. Only makes us want to make bigger and better episodes. And with all that being said, thank you to all of you fine listeners for listening. And don't forget, the silence are golden, and the talkies, they're just a fad.